While digesting Reader's Digest in the back of the dirty bookstore, a plastic flag with gum on the back fell out on the floor. Well, I picked it up and I ran outside, slapped it on the window shield. And if I could see old Betsy Ross, I'd tell her how good I feel. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. Well, I went to the bank this morning, and the cashier said to me, if you join the Christmas club, we'll give you 10 of them flags for free. Well, I didn't mess around a bit. I took him up on what he said, and I stuck them stickers all over my car and one on my wife's forehead. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. Well, I got my window shields filled with flags I couldn't see, so I ran the car upside a curb right into a tree. By the time they got a doctor down, I was already dead. And I'll never understand why the man standing in the pearly gates said, but your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. We're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore.
Thank you for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We only have a few minutes left to Carmen Math with Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, and John Hoffmeister, CEO of Citizens for Affordable Energy. And then after that, Tapping Volcanoes for Energy. Scientists are exploring new technologies to harness the power of dormant volcanoes for geothermal energy.
The reality that disturbs... The reality that serves me the most is we don't learn. We just don't learn. And I'm committed to teaching. The point
best
about
way,
not learning...
The best way to teach at this point, probably, is not to tell people what to do. It's to put a serious price on carbon in the ways that we're describing so that people can then quickly learn what it is that is, you know, that our behaviors are costing. Not just us, but everyone who comes after us. And that price, because we've delayed for so long, that price has to keep getting higher and higher. The one thing no one has taken issue with is the fact that we have to keep 80% of the declared reserves we've found underground at this point. That's going to be expensive because we keep delaying. And every time we say, well, let's have another presidential commission or let's spend some money on research or whatever else, we get a few more years down this road. We go past at current rates of burning carbon, that 560 gigaton figure, we go past in 15 years. That's when we go past that 2-degree threshold. We don't have time for all of this. We have to make our democracy work correctly. And it won't work correctly as long as API and the fossil fuel industry is pouring money here and elsewhere into making sure that nothing ever changes.
Can you envision those assets in the ground becoming liabilities, John Hoffmeister?
At this point, no, because China was at 5 million barrels a day of oil consumption in 2005. 10 million barrels a day in 2011. There'll be at 15 million barrels a day in roughly 2015. There'll be at 20 million barrels a day consumption by 2020. Those assets in the ground will not be liabilities on a global basis.
Right.
China's going to grow its demand, and there's nothing the U.S. is going to do to stop it.
Let's get another audience question in here at Climate One. Yes, sir.
I'm Felix Kramer. I actually like the first part of this better when Bill was just talking about the reality of the issue and not engaging, because in a certain way, we hear ads around here of Chevron saying, let's talk. But I wonder, Bill obviously did a lot of research about Shell, and he talked about it. I wonder if you read his Rolling Stone article, and if you've done that math. Because if you, as a former CEO, you understand that you have a fiduciary responsibility to your company. What if the things you support, getting corporate money out of the elections and taxing carbon, succeed in getting to a situation where 80% of your industry's reserves are proscribed, and globally the national oil companies the nationally owned oil companies around the world, which own far more oil than the private companies, if they're proscribed also, what happens to your industry at that point?
I think the industry would, if the scenario played out as you described it, the industry would shrink. But society would, the economies of the world would shrink even more. And relatively, in a democracy, people wouldn't tolerate it. We don't have the consensus, ladies and gentlemen. In a democracy, we don't have the consensus. Bill and I are actually helping to contribute to the consensus by bringing separate points of view, but with common ends. And our difference, as I said earlier, I think he may disagree, is largely in the timing. But until we achieve a consensus on any aspect of this, no public policy will come into effect. And you could penalize the oil companies all you want, they'll go somewhere else. They don't want to be where they're not wanted. And they pull out of countries where they're not wanted. But the world is a bigger place than the United States. And I have great respect for what ClimateWorks is doing because it's helping to contribute to a consensus. But the reality is people live every day in an economy and a society where they like the way they live.
The world is capable of changing. And one of the things that would help it change most is some leadership from the country that poured the most carbon into the atmosphere over the last century. The Chinese are actually installing more renewable capacity than anybody on Earth. 25% of Chinese, when they take a shower at night, the hot water is coming off the roof. I spent a day with the head of the biggest solar hot water company in China, Heimin Solar, a guy named Huang Ming, an engineer. And at the end of this great day, he took me into his private museum. He said, there on the ground was a solar panel. You know what that is? No, what is that? That's one of the solar panels that Jimmy Carter put on the White House in 1979, and Ronald Reagan took down in 1985 because basically the fossil fuel industry didn't like the idea of solar panels up there. That's proof to me that what we lack is not technology, it's political will, and the people who've been getting in the way of that political will are the fossil fuel industry, and if they get out of the way, or if they help, then we'll make some progress.
With all due respect, the people who are in the way of what you're espousing are your fellow citizens and their leaders. It is the American people who buy cars, the American people who buy gasoline,
the biggest contributors
who over-air condition their homes and overheat their homes.
Fair enough.
They are the people who are contributing to this.
But instead of trying to make everybody feel even more guilty than they already do, think for a minute about the fact that the biggest contributors in this last election cycle were people like the Koch brothers, third and fourth richest people in the country, fossil fuel barons. Think about the fact that the last election cycle, it was the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce filed a brief with the EPA. This will demonstrate the extent of how engaging with them didn't work. They filed a brief with the EPA saying, don't regulate carbon because if on some strange chance that all the scientists turn out to be correct and the planet warms, it won't be a problem because humans will be able to alter their behavior and physiology in order to cope with this problem. I mean, that's the level of denial that we've had to deal with. And I'm glad now that you're out of the industry that and I really do admire your work in coming to deal with this, but I admire even more the work of people all around the world, many of whom did nothing to cause the problem that we're dealing with, but are now standing up to say, we can come together and figure out how to make this happen, not 50 years down the road when the temperature is 5 degrees higher and things like Sandy are an everyday occurrence. We can figure out, not easily, but we can figure out how to make it happen now, before we break the planet.
Let's get one more audience question. Yes, sir. Welcome to Climate One.
Thank you. I'm Dave Masson. I'm also a member of Citizens Climate Lobby. And John, first, I also appreciate your being here today on a bit of a hot seat. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with Mark Jacobson's research at Stanford that indicates we can convert the entire world to renewable energy in 20 to 40 years using technology we have now at no greater cost than what we're already spending on our energy system. And if you're not aware, I'd be happy to send it to you. But I do have a question.
We're really tight, so we got a big line behind you. So let's get John to respond. Thank you.
I am aware of his work and admire it. And you know, again, public policy is either an enabler or a disabler. And so I've been, even while at Shell, so my voice is the same outside of Shell as at Shell, because I was promoting the enabling of public policy to help these things occur, help the transition develop. But it all has to also be economic. I think we're struggling here with how does renewable energy compete commercially? And I know there are arguments that just it has to reach a certain scale. I would argue it also has to reach a certain level of technology to be efficient in order to reach that scale. So let's put the enablers in place, but let's not deceive ourselves to believe that somehow the status quo is suddenly going to be overcome in a time frame that's not realistic. I think we mislead ourselves or mislead our young people if we say something that's just not going to happen. So that's, in that sense, I'm a pragmatist.
Yes, sir. Welcome to Climate One. Let's have another question.
Hi, I'm Rosecrans, citizen. If the United States Congress implements some sort of economic incentive, whether it's a tax or cap and trade, and technology outperforms all expectations, and we do a great, great job, but the rest of the world, China in particular, but many others, don't come along and, in fact, increase. At what point, when we worry about Greenland and Antarctica melting, do we go to a heretical solution like some sort of geoengineering? And as hopefully a transition, or, you know, who knows, but do we rule that out entirely because it's so crazy, or is it part of the thinking?
Bill McKibben?
Geoengineering is, you know, there may come a time if things, you know, if the industry stays as intransigent as they have, when we have to have some kind of break the glass solution, I suppose. But if we do, it's horrible. I mean, it would be the last thing to which we should turn. The idea that having filled the atmosphere with carbon, maybe now we should pour in a lot of sulfur in order to try and somehow ameliorate it. I mean, the modeling of it isn't good. The effects, the side effects will be enormous. And also, in the end, it's just kind of this horrible admission of defeat, you know, that we weren't able as a society to constrain ourselves, restrain ourselves, make the kind of creative leap in a new direction. Instead, almost like an addict, just, you know, unable to come to terms with that addiction and clean up their lives, we just had to find some, you know, weird fix in order to try and keep going our way of life. So I hope very much that it doesn't come to that, especially since there's no real reason to think it would work, even if we did it.
Steve Schneider once called it planetary methadone. We have to end it there. Our thanks to John Hofmeister, former president of Shell Oil, and Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org.
Very good.
For coming to Climate One today.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Coming up next, tapping volcanoes for energy. Scientists are exploring new technologies to harness the power of dormant volcanoes for geothermal energy. Dave Blackwell, an earth scientist professor at Southern Methodist University, tells Steve Curwood that volcanoes could power millions of homes.
Every night in my dreams, I see you, I feel you. That is how I know you. Go on, far across the distance and spaces between us.
The problems associated with many forms of energy are giving a boost to novel developments, including enhanced geothermal power. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management has just given permission to tap a volcano in the Cascade Mountain Range in Oregon. The company, Altarock Energy, will drill into the Newberry volcano that's been dormant for about 1,600 years. David Blackwell is an earth sciences professor at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, and a technical advisor on the project.
There's a lot of very hot rock associated with the volcano. So what will happen is the wells will have to be drilled, and then a crack will be created between two wells that allows water to be pumped down one well and extracted from the other well after it's heated up by running through the rock, and then the hot water will be separated into steam and run through a turbine to the surface. Then the water that is produced from that well will be reinjected back into the first well, and the cycle just continues.
How hot is it down there?
It's about 600 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's quite warm.
Now, how safe is this? I mean, drilling cracks into rock in an area that's inherently unstable seems like risky business. It kind of sounds like hydraulic fracturing to get natural gas.
The process is very similar to the fracturing they use to get the gas shales. But in particular with geothermal, there's been a number of high-level studies to determine how to do this process in the best, safest way and how to monitor it to make sure that the process doesn't cause some kind of a problem.
Now, I understand that the Newberry volcano is on Bureau of Land Management land. That's federal land. And the Bureau has now given the green light to start drilling these wells. So what might be the danger to wildlife in the area?
The actual site of the well is within a clear-cut section. So this is not an area that's extensively used by the wildlife.
How much infrastructure is involved?
Very little, except on the drill pad, which occupies about, I think, maybe 5 acres. And all the equipment will be on that pad. There's a road, but the roads are already built essentially because of the timbering. There's extensive timbering on the side of the volcano.
So what's the potential here? How much energy do you expect to get from the wells at the Newberry volcano when it's up and running?
We estimate that there's potentially about 2,000 megawatts of power that could be developed, and that's enough to basically run a city of 1 million people.
What's the overall potential for hot rock energy for the United States?
The potential is immense because once we can develop the technology, then we can make accessible areas which were not previously utilizable from geothermal power. And so this could really increase by orders of magnitude the amount of geothermal power that the United States could develop. Right now there's on the order of 3,000 megawatts, but it could easily go to 10 to 20 times that number.
So, Professor, how benign is this form of energy compared to the other choices we have out there? I think of burning coal, I think of nuclear power, I think of solar and wind.
Well, compared to solar and wind, geothermal is considered baseload. So geothermal can operate 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, whereas both solar and wind are very intermittent. And so they require other types of power to supplement them when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. Compared to coal, geothermal is extremely clean, so there are no emissions. The technology would be somewhat similar to the shale gas, but of course, again, burning gas generates CO2, but not nearly as much. It's not nearly as polluting as coal.
And compared to nuclear?
And nuclear, one has to look at the whole sequence of power source from the mining, which generates pollution because you're opening up ground which has radioactive materials in it, potentially subjecting that to groundwater, you're refining it, but then when you've spent the fuel, we still don't know what we're doing with all of this waste fuel. And so nuclear has a whole series of very complicated problems that have to be dealt with.
This enhanced geothermal system sounds too good to be true. No pollution, all the steam that you need, you could power millions of homes with it. What's the catch?
The catch are two. One, we haven't done it, and two, it's going to be probably a little bit more expensive than most of the other sources, with the potential exception of perhaps nuclear. But that's why it's really important for there to be some support for the research of this type, because we need to find out if this is a source which we can develop, because it could have a very, very significant impact on a lot of factors dealing with energy in the United States.
David Blackwell is an earth sciences professor at Southern Methodist University. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Song is about you. You're so vain.
You're so vain.
I'll bet. That's all, folks.